You guys should try solving your problems like we do. A fistfight here and there might do you royals some good. Both Lissa and Christian laughed at this. He glanced up at her with a sly smile, showing his fangs as he did.
What do you think? I bet I could take you if we went one-on-one.
You wish, she teased. Her troubled feelings lightened.
I do, actually,
he said, holding her gaze. There was an intensely sensual note to his voice that made her heart race. Jealousy shot through me. She and I had been best friends our entire life. I could read her mind. But the fact remained, Christian was a huge part of her world now, and he played a role I never could. Just as he could never have a part of the connection that existed between me and her. We both sort of accepted but didn't like the fact that we had to split her attention. And at times, it seems the truce we held for her sake was paper thin. Lissa brushed her hand against his cheek. Behave.
I am,
he told her, his voice still a little husky.
Sometimes. But sometimes you don't want me to.
Groaning, I stood up.
God, I'm going to leave you guys alone now.
Lissa blinked and dragged her eyes away from Christian, suddenly looking embarrassed.
Sorry,
she murmured. A delicate pink flush spread over her cheeks. Since she was pale like all Maroi, it actually sort of made her look prettier. Not that she needed much help in that department.
You don't have to go.
No, it's fine. I'm exhausted, I assured her. Christian didn't look too broken up about seeing me leave.
I'll catch you tomorrow.
I started to turn away, but Lissa called to me. Rose, are you sure you're okay? After everything that happened? I met her jade green eyes. Her concern was so strong and deep that it made my chest ache. I might be closer to her than anyone else in the world, but I didn't want her worrying about me. It was my job to keep her safe. She shouldn't be troubled about protecting me, particularly if Strigoi had suddenly decided to make a hit list of royals. I flashed her a saucy grin. I'm fine. Nothing to worry about except you guys tearing each other's clothes off before I get a chance to leave.
Then you'd better go now,
said Christian dryly. She elbowed him, and I rolled my eyes.
Good night,
I told them. As soon as my back was to them, my smile vanished. I walked back to my dorm with a heavy heart, hoping I wouldn't dream about the Badikas tonight. Chapter 3 The lobby of my dorm was abuzz when I sprinted downstairs to my before-school practice. The commotion didn't surprise me. A good night's sleep had gone far to chase away the images from last night. But I knew neither I nor my classmates would easily forget what had taken place outside Billings. And yet, as I studied the faces and clusters of other novices, I noticed something weird. The fear and tension from yesterday were still around, certainly. But something new was there, too. Excitement. A couple of freshman novices were practically squealing with joy as they spoke in hushed whispers. Nearby, a group of guys my own age were gesturing wildly, enthusiastic grins on their faces. I had to be missing something here, unless all of yesterday had been a dream. It took every ounce of self-control I had not to go over and ask somebody what was happening. If I delayed, I'd be late for practice. The curiosity was killing me, though. Had the Strigoi and their humans been found and killed? That would certainly be good news. But something told me that wasn't the case. Pushing open the front doors, I lamented that I'd just have to wait until breakfast to find out.
Hathaway, don't run away, a sing-song voice called.
I glanced behind me and grinned. Mason Ashford, another novice and a good friend of mine, jogged up and fell in step with me.
What are you, 12?
I asked, continuing on toward the gym.
Nearly,
he said.
I missed your smiling face yesterday. Where were you?
Apparently, my presence at the Badika house still wasn't widely known. It wasn't a secret or anything, but I didn't want to discuss any gory details.
Had a training thing with Dimitri.
God, muttered Mason.
That guy is always working you. Doesn't he realize he's depriving us of your beauty and charm?
Smiling face, beauty and charm. You're laying it on a little thick this morning, aren't you? I laughed.
Hey, I'm just telling it like it is.
Really? You're lucky to have someone as suave and brilliant as me paying this much attention to you.
I kept grinning. Mason was a huge flirt, and he liked to flirt with me in particular. Part of it was just because I was good at it, and I liked to flirt back. But I knew his feelings toward me were more than just friendly, and I was still deciding how I felt about that. He and I had the same goofy sense of humor and frequently drew attention to ourselves in class and among friends. He had gorgeous blue eyes and messy red hair that never seemed to lie flat. It was cute. But dating someone new was going to be kind of difficult when I still kept thinking about the time I was half-naked in bed with Dimitri.
Suave and brilliant, huh?
I shook my head. I don't think you pay nearly as much attention to me as you do your ego. Someone needs to knock it down a little.
Oh, yeah?
He asked.
Well, you can try your best on the slopes.
I stopped walking.
The what?
The slopes. He tilted his head.
You know, the ski trip.
What ski trip? I was apparently missing something serious here.
Where have you been this morning?
He asked, looking at me like I was a crazy woman.
In bed. I only got up like 5 minutes ago.
Now, start from the beginning and tell me what you're talking about. I shivered from the lack of movement.
And let's keep walking.
We did.
So, you know how everyone's afraid to have their kids come home for Christmas. Well, there's this huge ski lodge in Idaho that's exclusively used by Royals and Rich Maroy. The people who own it are opening it up for Academy students and their families, and actually any other Maroy who want to go. With everyone in one spot, they're going to have a ton of guardians to protect the place, so it'll be totally safe.
You can't be serious, I said. We reached the gym and stepped inside out of the cold.
Mason nodded eagerly. It's true. The place is supposed to be amazing.
He gave me the grin that always made me smile in return.
We're going to live like royalty, Rose. At least for a week or so. We take off the day after Christmas.
I stood there, both excited and stunned. I hadn't seen this coming. It really was a brilliant idea, one that let families reunite safely. And what a reunion spot! A royal ski lodge? I'd expected to spend most of my holiday break hanging out here and watching TV with Lissa and Christian. Now, I'd be living it up in 5-star accommodations. Lobster dinners, massages, cute ski instructors. Mason's enthusiasm was contagious. I could feel it welling up in me, and then, suddenly, it slammed to a halt. Studying my face, he saw the change right away.
What's wrong? This is cool.
It is, I admitted. And I get why everyone's excited, but the reason we're getting to go to this fancy place is because, well, because people are dead. I mean, doesn't this all seem weird?
Mason's cheery expression sobered a little. Yeah, but we're alive, Rose. We can't stop living because other people are dead. And we have to make sure more people don't die. That's why this place is such a great idea. It's safe.
His eyes turned stormy.
God, I can't wait until we're out of here and in the field. After hearing about what happened, I just want to go tear apart some Strigoi. I wish we could go now, you know? There's no reason. They could use the extra help, and we pretty much know everything we need to.
The fierceness in his voice reminded me of my outburst yesterday, though he wasn't quite as worked up as I'd been. His eagerness to act was impetuous and naive, whereas mine had been born out of some weird, dark irrationality I still didn't entirely understand. When I didn't respond, Mason gave me a puzzled look.
Don't you want to?
I don't know, Mace. I stared down at the floor, avoiding his eyes as I studied the toe of my shoe. I mean, I don't want Strigoi out there, attacking people either. And I want to stop them, in theory, but, well, we aren't even close to being ready. I've seen what they can do. I don't know. Rushing in isn't the answer. I shook my head and looked back up. Good grief. I sounded so logical and cautious. I sounded like Dimitri. It's not important since it's not going to happen anyway. I suppose we should just be excited about the trip, huh? Mason's moods were quick to change, and he turned easygoing once more.
Yep, and you'd better try to remember how to ski, because I'm calling you out on knocking down my ego out there. Not that it's going to happen.
I smiled again. Boy, it sure is going to be sad when I make you cry. I kind of feel guilty already.
He opened his mouth, no doubt to deliver some smart-ass reply, and then caught sight of something. Or rather, someone behind me. I glanced over and saw Dimitri's tall form approaching from the other side of the gym.
Mason swept me a gallant bow.
Your lord and master.
Catch you later, Hathaway. Start planning your ski strategies.
He opened the door and disappeared into the frigid darkness. I turned around and joined Dimitri. Like other Dampier novices, I spend half of my school day on one form or another of guardian training, be it actual physical combat or learning about Strigoi and how to defend against them. Novices also sometimes had practices after school. I, however, was in a unique situation. I still stood by my decision to run away from St. Vladimir's. Victor Doshkov had posed too much of a threat to Lyssa, but our extended vacation had come with consequences. Being away for 2 years had put me behind in my guardian classes, so the school had declared that I had to make up for it by going to extra practices before and after school. With Dimitri. Little did they know that they were also giving me lessons in avoiding temptation. But my attraction to him aside, I was a fast learner. And with his help, I had almost caught up to the other seniors. Since he wasn't wearing a coat, I knew we'd be working inside today, which was good news. It was freezing out. Yet even the happiness I felt over that was nothing compared to what I felt when I saw what exactly he had set up in one of the training rooms. There were practice dummies arranged on the far wall, dummies that looked amazingly lifelike. No straw-stuffed burlap bags here. There were men and women wearing ordinary clothes with rubbery skin and different hair and eye colors. Their expressions ranged from happy to scared to angry. I'd worked with these dummies before in other trainings, using them to practice kicks and punches, but I'd never worked with them while holding what Dimitri held, a silver stake. Sweet, I breathed. It was identical to the one I'd found at the Badika house. It had a hand grip at the bottom, almost like a hilt without the little side flourishes. That was where its resemblance to a dagger ended. Rather than a flat blade, the stake had a thick, rounded body that narrowed to a point, kind of like an ice pick. The entire thing was a little shorter than my forearm. Dimitri leaned casually against the wall in an easy stance he always pulled off remarkably well, despite being almost 6'7". With one hand, he tossed the stake into the air. It spun around in a cartwheel a couple of times and then came down. He caught it, hilt first. Please tell me I get to learn how to do that today, I said. Amusement flashed in the dark depths of his eyes. I think he had a hard time keeping a straight face around me sometimes.
You'll be lucky if I let you hold it today, he said.
He flipped the stake into the air again. My eyes followed it longingly. I started to point out that I had already held one, but I knew that line of logic would get me nowhere. Instead, I tossed my backpack on the floor, threw off my coat, and crossed my arms expectantly. I had on loose pants tied at the waist and a tank top with a hoodie over it. My dark hair was pulled brutally back into a ponytail. I was ready for anything. You want me to tell you how they work and why I should always be cautious around them, I announced. Dimitri stopped flipping the stake and stared at me in astonishment. Come on, I laughed. You don't think I know how you work by now? We've been doing this for almost 3 months. You always make me talk safety and responsibility before I can do anything fun.
I see, he said.
Well, I guess you've got it all figured out.
By all means, go on with the lesson. I'll just wait over here until you need me again.
He tucked the stake into a leather sheath hanging from his belt and then made himself comfortable against the wall, hands stuffed in pockets. I waited, figuring he was joking. But when he said nothing else, I realized he'd meant his words. With a shrug, I launched into what I knew. Silver always has powerful effects on any magical creature. It can help or hurt them if you put enough power into it. These stakes are really hardcore because it takes 4 different moroi to make them, and they use each of the elements during the forging. I frowned, suddenly considering something. Well, except spirit. So these things are supercharged and are about the only non-decapitating weapon that can do damage to a Strigoi. But to kill them, it has to be through the heart.
Will they hurt you?
I shook my head. No. I mean, well, yeah. If you drive one through my heart, it will. But it won't hurt me like it would hurt a Moroi. Scratch one of them with this, and it'll hit them pretty hard. But not as hard as it hit a Strigoi. And they won't hurt humans either. I stopped for a moment and stared absent-mindedly at the window behind Dimitri. Frost covered the glass in sparkling crystalline patterns, but I hardly noticed. Mentioning humans and stakes had transported me back to the Badika house. Blood and death flashed through my thoughts. Seeing Dimitri watching me, I shook off the memories and kept going with the lesson. Dimitri would occasionally give a nod or ask a clarifying question. As the time ticked down, I kept expecting him to tell me I was finished and could start hacking up the dummies. Instead, he waited until almost 10 minutes before the end of our session before leading me over to one of them. It was a man with blonde hair and a goatee. Dimitri took the stake out of its sheath, but didn't hand it to me.
"Where are you going to put this?"
he asked. "In the heart," I replied irritably. "I already told you that 100 times. Can I have it now?" He allowed himself a smile.
"Where's the heart?"
I gave him an are-you-serious look. He merely shrugged. With overdramatic emphasis, I pointed to the left side of the dummy's chest. Dimitri shook his head.
"That's not where the heart is," he told me.
"Sure it is. People put their hands over their hearts when they say the Pledge of Allegiance or sing the national anthem." He continued to stare at me expectantly. I turned back to the dummy and studied it. In the back of my brain, I remembered learning CPR and where we had to place our hands. I tapped the center of the dummy's chest. "Is it here?" He arched an eyebrow. Normally, I thought that was cool. Today, it was just annoying.
"I don't know," he said. "Is it?"
"That's what I'm asking you!"
"You shouldn't have to ask me. Don't you all have to take physiology?"
"Yeah, junior year. I was on vacation, remember?"
I pointed to the gleaming stake.
"Can I please touch it now?"
He flipped the stake again, letting it flash in the light, and then it disappeared in the sheath. "I want you to tell me where the heart is the next time we meet. Exactly where. And I want to know what's in the way of it, too."
I gave him my fiercest glare, which, judging from his expression, must not have been that fierce. 9 out of 10 times, I thought Dimitri was the sexiest thing walking the earth. Then, there were times like this. I headed off to first period, a combat class, in a bad mood. I didn't like looking incompetent in front of Dimitri, and I'd really, really wanted to use one of those stakes. So in class, I took out my annoyance on anyone I could punch or kick. By the end of class, no one wanted to spar with me. I'd accidentally hit Meredith, one of the few other girls in my class, so hard that she'd felt it through her shin padding. She was going to have an ugly bruise and kept looking at me as though I'd done it on purpose. I apologized to no avail. Afterward, Mason found me once again.
"Oh, man," he said, studying my face. "Who pissed you off?"
I immediately launched into my tale of silver stake and heart woes. To my annoyance, he laughed.
"How do you not know where the heart is, especially considering how many of them you've broken?"
I gave him the same ferocious look I'd given Dimitri. This time, it worked. Mason's face paled.
"Belikov is a sick, evil man who should be thrown into a pit of rabid vipers for the great offense he committed against you this morning."
"Thank you," I said primly. Then I considered. "Can vipers be rabid?"
"I don't see why not. Everything can be, I think."
He held the hallway door open for me.
"Canadian geese might be worse than vipers, though."
I gave him a sidelong look. Canadian geese are deadlier than vipers? You ever tried to feed those little bastards? He asked, attempting seriousness and failing. They're vicious. You get thrown to vipers, you die quickly. But the geese? That'll go on for days. More suffering.
Wow. I don't know whether I should be impressed or frightened that you've thought about all this, I remarked.
Just trying to find creative ways to avenge your honor. That's all.
You just never struck me as the creative type, Mace.
We stood outside our second period classroom. Mason's expression was still light and joking, but there was a suggestive note in his voice when he spoke again.
Rose, when I'm around you, I think of all sorts of creative things to do.
I was still giggling about the vipers and abruptly stopped, staring at him in surprise. I'd always thought Mason was cute, but with that serious, smoky look in his eyes, it suddenly occurred to me for the first time that he was actually kind of sexy.
Oh, look at that!
He laughed, noticing how much he'd caught me off guard.
Rose gets rendered speechless. Ashford, 1. Hathaway, 0.
Hey, I don't want to make you cry before the trip. It won't be any fun if I've already broken you before we even hit the slopes.
He laughed and we stepped into the room. This was a class on bodyguard theory, one that took place in an actual classroom instead of the practice field. It was a nice break from all the physical exertion. Today, there were 3 guardians standing in front who weren't from the school's regiment. Holiday visitors, I realized. Parents and their guardians had already started coming to campus to accompany their children to the ski resort. My interest was piqued immediately. One of the guests was a tall guy who looked like he was about 100 years old but could still kick major ass. The other guy was about Dimitri's age. He had deeply tanned skin and was built well enough that a few of the girls in class looked ready to swoon. The last guardian was a woman. Her auburn hair was cropped and curly, and her brown eyes were currently narrowed in thought. As I've said, a lot of Dampier women choose to have children rather than follow the guardian path. Since I, too, was one of the few women in this profession, I was always excited to meet others, like Tamara. Only this wasn't Tamara. This was someone I'd known for years, someone who triggered anything but pride and excitement. Instead, I felt resentment. Resentment, anger, and burning outrage. The woman standing in front of the class was my mother.
Chapter 4.
I couldn't believe it. Janine Hathaway, my mother. My insanely famous and stunningly absent mother. She was no Arthur Schoenberg, but she did have a pretty stellar reputation in the Guardian world. I hadn't seen her in years, because she was always off on some insane mission. And yet, here she was at the Academy right now, right in front of me. And she hadn't even bothered to let me know she was coming. So much for motherly love. What the hell was she doing here anyway? The answer came quickly. All the Moroi who came to campus would have their guardians in tow. My mother protected a noble from the Seltsky clan, and several members of that family had shown up for the holidays. Of course she'd be here with him. I slid into my chair and felt something inside of me shrivel up. I knew she had to have seen me come in, but her attention was focused elsewhere. She had on jeans and a beige T-shirt, covered with what had to be the most boring denim jacket I'd ever seen. At only 5 feet tall, she was dwarfed by the other guardians, but she had a presence and a way of standing that made her seem taller. Our instructor, Stan, introduced the guests and explained that they were going to share real-life experiences with us. He paced the front of the room, bushy eyebrows knitting together as he spoke.
"I know this is unusual,"
he explained.
"Visiting guardians usually don't have time to stop by our classes. Our 3 guests, however, have made time to come to talk to you today in light of what's happened recently."
He paused a moment, and no one needed to tell us what he was referring to. The Badika attack. He cleared his throat and tried again.
In light of what's happened, we thought it might better prepare you to learn from those currently working in the field.
The class tensed with excitement. Hearing stories, particularly ones with a lot of blood and action, was a hell of a lot more interesting than analyzing theory from a textbook. Apparently, some of the other campus guardians thought so too. They often stopped by our classes, but they were present today in larger than usual number. Dimitri stood among them in the back. The old guy went first. He launched into his story, and I found myself getting hooked in. It described a time when the youngest son of the family he guarded had wandered off in a public place that Strogoi were lurking in. "The sun was about to set," he told us in a gravelly voice. He swept his hands in a downward motion, apparently to demonstrate how a sunset worked. "There were only two of us, and we had to make a snap decision on how to proceed." I leaned forward, elbows propped up on my desk. Guardians often worked in pairs. One, the near guard, usually stayed close to those being guarded, while the other, the far guard, scouted the area. The far guard still usually stayed within eye contact, so I recognized the dilemma here. Thinking about it, I decided that if I were in that situation, I'd have the near guardian take the rest of the family to a secure location while the other guardian searched for the boy.
"We had the family stay inside a restaurant with my partner while I swept the rest of the area," continued the old guardian.
He spread his hands out in a sweeping motion, and I felt smug over having made the correct call. The story ended happily, with a found boy and no Strogoi encounters. The second guy's anecdote talked about how he'd gotten the drop on a Strogoi stalking some Maroi.
"I wasn't even technically on duty," he said.
He was the really cute one, and a girl sitting near me stared at him with wide, adoring eyes.
"I was visiting a friend in the family he guarded. As I was leaving their apartment, I saw a Strogoi lurking in the shadows. He never expected a guardian to be out there. I circled the block, came up behind him, and..."
The man made a staking motion, far more dramatic than the old guy's hand gestures had been. The storyteller even went so far as to mimic twisting the stake into the Strogoi's heart. And then it was my mother's turn. A scowl spread over my face before she even said a word. A scowl that grew worse when she actually launched into the story. I swear, if I didn't believe her incapable of having the imagination for it, and her bland clothing choices proved she really didn't have an imagination, I would have thought she was lying. It was more than a story. It was an epic tale, the kind of thing that gets made into movies and wins Oscars. She talked about how her charge, Lord Seltzky, and his wife had attended a ball put on by another prominent royal family. Several Strogoi had been lying in wait. My mother discovered one, promptly staked it, and then alerted the other guardians present. With their help, she hunted down the other Strogoi lurking around and performed most of the kills herself.
"It wasn't easy," she explained.
From anyone else, that statement would have sounded like bragging. Not her. There was a briskness to the way she spoke, an efficient way of stating facts that left no room for flourishes. She'd been raised in Glasgow, and some of her words still had a Scottish lilt.
"There were three others on the premises. At the time, that was considered an unusually large number to be working together. That's not necessarily true now, considering the Badika massacre."
A few people flinched at the casual way she spoke about the attack. Once again, I could see the bodies.
"We had to dispatch the remaining Strogoi as quickly and quietly as possible, so as not to alert the others. Now, if you have the element of surprise, the best way to take Strogoi is to come around from behind, break their necks, and then stake them. Breaking their necks won't kill them, of course, but it stuns them and allows you to do the staking before they can make any noise. The most difficult part is actually sneaking up on them, because their hearing is so acute. Since I'm smaller and lighter than most guardians, I can move fairly quietly, so I ended up performing two of the three kills myself."
Again, she used that matter-of-fact tone as she described her own stealthy skills. It was annoying, more so than if she'd been openly haughty about how awesome she was. My classmates' faces shone with wonder. They were clearly more interested in the idea of breaking a Strogoi's neck than analyzing my mother's narrative skills. She continued with the story. When she and the other guardians had killed the remaining Strogoi, they discovered two Moroi had been taken from the party. Such an act wasn't uncommon for Strogoi. Sometimes they wanted to save Moroi for a later snack. Sometimes lower-ranking Strogoi were dispatched by more powerful ones to bring back prey. Regardless, two Moroi were gone from the ball, and their guardian had been injured.
Naturally, we couldn't leave those Moroi in Strogoi clutches, she said. We tracked the Strogoi to their hideout and found several of them living together. I'm sure you can recognize how rare that is.
It was. The evil and selfish nature of Strogoi made them turn on each other as easily as they did their victims. Organizing for attacks, when they had an immediate and bloody goal in mind, was the best they could do. But living together? No. It was almost impossible to imagine.
We managed to free the two captive Moroi, only to discover that others were being held prisoner,
my mother said.
We couldn't send the ones we'd rescued back by themselves, though. So the guardians who were with me escorted them out and left it to me to get the others.
Yes, of course, I thought. My mother bravely went in alone. Along the way, she got captured but managed to escape and rescue the prisoners. In doing so, she performed what had to be the hat trick of the century, killing Strogoi in all three ways, staking, decapitation, and setting them on fire.
I had just staked a Strogoi when two more attacked. She explained. I didn't have time to pull the stake out when the others jumped me. Fortunately, there was an open fireplace nearby, and I pushed one of the Strogoi into it. The last one chased me outside, into an old shed. There was an axe inside, and I used that to cut off her head. I then took a can of gasoline and returned to the house. The one I'd thrown into the fireplace hadn't completely burned, but once I doused him in gasoline, he went out pretty quickly.
The classroom was in awe as she spoke. Mouths dropped, eyes bugged, not a sound could be heard. Glancing around, I felt like time had frozen for everyone. Except me. I appeared to be the only one unimpressed by her harrowing tale, and seeing the awe on everyone's faces enraged me. When she finished, a dozen hands shot up as the class peppered her with questions about her techniques, whether she was scared, etc. After about the 10th question, I couldn't take it anymore. I raised my hand. It took her a while to notice and call on me. She seemed mildly astonished to find me in class. I considered myself lucky that she even recognized me.
"So, Guardian Hathaway," I began, "why didn't you guys just secure the place?"
She frowned. I think she'd gone on her guard the moment she called on me.
"What do you mean?"
I shrugged and slouched back in my desk, attempting a casual and conversational air.
I don't know. It seems to me like you guys messed up. Why didn't you scope out the place and make sure it was clear of Strogoi in the first place? Seems like you could have saved yourself a lot of trouble.
All eyes in the room turned toward me. My mother was momentarily at a loss for words.
If we hadn't gone through all that trouble, there'd be 7 more Strogoi walking the world, and those other captured Moroi would be dead or turned by now.
Yeah, I get how you guys saved the day and all that, but I'm going back to the principles here. I mean, this is a theory class, right?
I glanced over at Stan, who was regarding me with a very stormy look. He and I had a long and unpleasant history of classroom conflicts, and I suspected we were on the verge of another.
So I just want to figure out what went wrong in the beginning.
I'll say this for her. My mother had a hell of a lot more self-control than I did. Had our roles been reversed, I would have walked over and smacked me by now. Her face stayed perfectly calm, however, and a small tightness in the set of her lips was the only sign that I was pissing her off.
It's not that simple, she replied. The venue had an extremely complex layout. We went through it initially and found nothing. It's believed the Strogoi came in after the festivities had started, or that there might have been passages and hidden rooms we hadn't been aware of.
The class oohed and aahed over the idea of hidden passages, but I wasn't impressed.
So what you're saying is that you guys either failed to detect them during your first sweep, or they broke through the security you set up during the party. Seems like someone messed up either way.
The tightness in her lips increased, and her voice grew frosty.
We did the best we could with an unusual situation.
I can see how someone at your level might not be able to grasp the intricacies of what I'm describing. But once you've actually learned enough to go beyond theory, you'll see how different it is when you're actually out there and lives are in your hands.
No doubt, I agreed. Who am I to question your methods? I mean, whatever gets you the Molnia marks, right?
Miss Hathaway.
Stan's deep voice rumbled through the room.
Please take your things and go wait outside for the remainder of class.
I stared at him in bewilderment.
Are you serious? Since when is there anything wrong with asking questions?
Your attitude is what's wrong.
He pointed at the door.
Go.
A silence heavier and deeper than when my mother had told her story descended over everyone. I did my best not to cower under the stares of guardians and novices alike.
This wasn't the first time I'd been kicked out of Stan's class. It wasn't even the first time I'd been kicked out of Stan's class while Dimitri was watching.
Slinging my backpack over my shoulder, I crossed the short distance to the door, a distance that felt like miles, and refused to make eye contact with my mother as I passed. About 5 minutes before the class let out, she slipped out of the room and walked over to where I sat in the hallway. Looking down on me, she put her hands on her hips in that annoying way that made her seem taller than she was. It wasn't fair that someone over half a foot shorter than me could make me feel so small.
Well, I see your manners haven't improved over the years.
I stood up and felt a glare snap into place.
Nice to see you, too. I'm surprised you even recognized me. In fact, I didn't even think you remembered me, seeing as how you never bothered to let me know you were on campus.
She shifted her hands from her hips and crossed her arms across her chest, becoming, if possible, even more impassive.
I couldn't neglect my duty to come coddle you.
Coddle?
I asked. This woman had never coddled me in her life. I couldn't believe she even knew the word.
I wouldn't expect you to understand. From what I hear, you don't really know what duty is.
I know exactly what it is, I retorted. My voice was intentionally haughty. Better than most people.
Her eyes widened in a sort of mock surprise. I used that sarcastic look on a lot of people and didn't appreciate having it directed toward me.
Oh, really? Where were you for the last 2 years?
Where were you for the last 5? I demanded. Would you have known I was gone if someone hadn't told you?
Don't turn this back on me. I was away because I had to be. You were away so you could go shopping and stay up late.
My hurt and embarrassment morphed into pure fury. Apparently, I was never going to live down the consequences of running away with Lyssa.
You have no idea why I left, I said, my voice's volume rising. And you have no right to make assumptions about my life when you don't know anything about it.
I've read reports about what happened. You had reason for concern, but you acted incorrectly.
Her words were formal and crisp. She could have been teaching one of my classes.
You should have gone to others for help.
There was no one I could go to, not when I didn't have hard proof. Besides, we've been learning that we're supposed to think independently.
Yes, she replied. Emphasis on learning, something you missed out on for 2 years. You're hardly in a position to lecture me about guardian protocol.
I wound up in arguments all the time. Something in my nature made that inevitable. So I was used to defending myself and having insults slammed at me. I had a tough skin. But somehow, around her, in the brief times I had been around her, I always felt like I was 3 years old. Her attitude humiliated me, and touching on my missed training, already a prickly subject, only made me feel worse. I crossed my arms in a fair imitation of her own stance and managed a smug look.
Yeah? Well, that's not what my teachers think. Even after missing all that time, I've still caught up with everyone in my class. She didn't answer right away. Finally, in a flat voice, she said,
"If you hadn't left, you would have surpassed them."
Turning military style, she walked off down the hall. A minute later, the bell rang, and the rest of Stan's class spilled into the hall. Even Mason couldn't cheer me up after that. I spent the rest of the day angry and annoyed, sure that everyone was whispering about my mother and me. I skipped lunch and went to the library to read a book about physiology and anatomy. When it was time for my after-school training with Dimitri, I practically ran up to the practice dummy. With a curled fist, I slapped its chest, very slightly to the left, but mostly in the center. "There," I told him. "The heart is there, and the sternum and ribs are in the way. Can I have the steak now?" Crossing my arms, I glanced up at him triumphantly, waiting for him to shower me with praise for my new cunning. Instead, he simply nodded in acknowledgement, like I should have already known that. And yeah, I should have.
"And how do you get through the sternum and the ribs?"
he asked. I sighed. I'd figured out the answer to one question, only to be given another. Typical. We spent a large part of the practice going over that, and he demonstrated several techniques that would yield the quickest kill. Every movement he made was both graceful and deadly. He made it look effortless, but I knew better. When he suddenly extended his hand and offered the steak to me, I didn't understand at first. "You're giving it to me?" His eyes sparkled.
"I can't believe you're holding back. I figured you would have taken it and run by now."
"Aren't you always teaching me to hold back?" I asked.
"Not on everything."
"But on some things." I heard the double meaning in my voice and wondered where it had come from. I'd accepted a while ago that there were too many reasons for me to even think about him romantically anymore. Every once in a while, I slipped a little and kind of wished he would, too. It'd have been nice to know that he still wanted me, that I still drove him crazy. Studying him now, I realized he might not ever slip because I didn't drive him crazy anymore. It was a depressing thought.
"Of course,"
he said, showing no indication we'd discussed anything other than class matters.
"It's like everything else. Balance. Know which things to run forward with, and know which to leave alone."
He placed a heavy emphasis on that last statement. Our eyes met briefly, and I felt electricity race through me. He did know what I was talking about, and like always, he was ignoring it and being my teacher, which is exactly what he should have been doing. With a sigh, I pushed my feelings for him out of my head and tried to remember that I was about to touch the weapon I'd been longing for since childhood. The memory of the Barika house came back to me yet again. The Strogoi were out there. I needed to focus. Hesitantly, almost reverentially, I reached out and curled my fingers around the hilt. The metal was cool and tingled against my skin. It was etched along the hilt for better grip. But in trailing my fingers over the rest of it, I found the surface to be as smooth as glass. I lifted it from his hand and brought it to me, taking a long time to study it and get used to its weight. An anxious part of me wanted to turn around and impale all of the dummies, but instead I looked up at Dimitri and asked, "What should I do first?" In his typical way, he covered basics first, honing the way I held and moved with the stake. Later on, he finally let me attack one of the dummies, at which point I did indeed discover it was not effortless. Evolution had done a smart thing in protecting the heart with the sternum and ribs. Yet through it all, Dimitri never faltered in diligence and patience, guiding me through every step and correcting the finest details.
"Slide up through the ribs,"
he explained, watching me try to fit the stake's point through a gap in the bones.
"It'll be easier since you're shorter than most of your attackers. Plus, you can slide along the lower rib's edge."
When practice ended, he took the stake back and nodded his approval.
"Good. Very good."
I glanced at him in surprise. He didn't usually hand out a lot of praise. "Really?"
"You do it like you've been doing it for years."
I felt a delighted grin creep over my face as we started leaving the practice room.
When we neared the door, I noticed a dummy with curly red hair. Suddenly, all the events from Stan's class came tumbling back into my head. I scowled. "Can I stake that one next time?" He picked up his coat and put it on. It was long and brown, made of distressed leather. It looked very much like a cowboy duster, though he'd never admit to it. He had a secret fascination with the Old West. I didn't really understand it, but then I didn't get his weird musical preferences either.
"I don't think that'd be healthy," he said.
"It'd be better than me actually doing it to her," I grumbled, slinging my backpack over one shoulder. We headed out to the gym.
"Violence isn't the answer to your problems," he said sagely.
"She's the one with the problem, and I thought the whole point of my education was that violence is the answer."
"Only to those who bring it to you first. Your mother isn't assaulting you. You two are just too much alike, that's all."
I stopped walking. "I'm not anything like her. I mean, we kind of have the same eyes, but I'm a lot taller, and my hair's completely different." I pointed to my ponytail just in case he wasn't aware that my thick brown-black hair didn't look like my mother's auburn curls. He still had kind of an amused expression, but there was something hard in his eyes, too.
"I'm not talking about your appearances, and you know it."
I looked away from that knowing gaze. My attraction to Dimitri had started almost as soon as we'd met. And it wasn't just because he was so hot, either. I felt like he understood part of me that I didn't understand myself. And sometimes I was pretty sure I understood parts of him that he didn't understand either. The only problem was that he had the annoying tendency to point out things about myself I didn't want to understand. "You think I'm jealous?"
"Are you?"
he asked. I hated it when he answered my questions with questions.
"If so, what are you jealous of exactly?"
I glanced back at Dimitri. "I don't know. Maybe I'm jealous of her reputation. Maybe I'm jealous because she's put more time into her reputation than into me. I don't know."
"You don't think what she did was great?"
"Yes." "No, I don't know. It just sounded like such a, I don't know, like she was bragging. Like she did it for the glory," I grimaced. "For the marks." Molniya marks were tattoos awarded to guardians when they killed Strogoi. Each one looked like a tiny X made of lightning bolts. They went on the back of our necks and showed how experienced a guardian was.
"You think facing down Strogoi is worth a few marks? I thought you'd learned something from the Bodica house."
I felt stupid. "That's not what I..."
"Come on."
I stopped walking.
"What?"
We'd been heading toward my dorm, but now he nodded his head toward the opposite side of campus.
"I want to show you something."
"What is it?"
"That not all marks are badges of honor."
Chapter 5. I had no idea what Dimitri was talking about, but I followed along obediently. To my surprise, he led me out of the boundaries of the campus and into the surrounding woods. The academy owned a lot of land, not all of which was actively used for educational purposes. We were in a remote part of Montana, and at times, it seemed as though the school was just barely holding back the wilderness. We walked quietly for a while, our feet crunching through thick, unbroken snow. A few birds flitted by, singing their greetings to the rising sun. But mostly, all I saw were scraggly, snow-heavy evergreen trees. I had to work to keep up with Dimitri's longer stride, particularly since the snow slowed me down a little. Soon, I discerned a large, dark shape ahead, some kind of building.
"What is that?"
I asked. Before he could answer, I realized it was a small cabin, made out of logs and everything. Closer examination showed that the logs looked worn and rotten in some places. The roof sagged a little.
"Old watch post," he said. "Guardians used to live on the edge of campus and keep watch for Strogoi."
"Why don't they anymore?"
"We don't have enough guardians to staff it. Besides, Moroi have warded campus with enough protective magic that most don't think it's necessary to have actual people on guard."
Provided no humans stake the wards, I thought.
For a few brief moments, I entertained the hope that Dimitri was leading me off to some romantic getaway. Then I heard voices on the opposite side of the building. A familiar hum of feeling coursed into my mind. Lissa was there. Dimitri and I rounded the corner of the building, coming up on a surprising scene. A small, frozen pond lay there, and Christian and Lissa were ice skating on it. A woman I didn't know was with them, but her back was to me. All I could see was a wave of jet-black hair that arced around her when she skated to a graceful stop. Lissa grinned when she saw me. "Rose!" Christian glanced over at me as she spoke, and I got the distinct impression he felt I was intruding on their romantic moment. Lissa moved in awkward strides to the pond's edge. She wasn't so adept at skating. I could only stare in bewilderment and jealousy. "Thanks for inviting me to the party."
"I figured you were busy," she said. "And this is secret anyway. We aren't supposed to be here."
I could have told them that.
Christian skated up beside her, and the strange woman soon followed.
"You bringing party crashers, Zimka?"
she asked.
I wondered who she was talking to, until I heard Dimitri laugh. He didn't do it that often, and my surprise increased.
"It's impossible to keep Rose away from places she shouldn't be. She always finds them eventually."
The woman grinned and turned around, flipping her long hair over one shoulder so that I suddenly saw her face full on. It took every ounce of my already dubiously held self-control not to react. Her heart-shaped face had large eyes exactly the same shade as Christian's, a pale wintry blue. The lips that smiled at me were delicate and lovely, glossed in a shade of pink that set off the rest of her features. But across her left cheek, marring what would have otherwise been smooth white skin, were raised purplish scars. Their shape and formation looked very much like someone had bitten into and torn out part of her cheek, which I realized was exactly what had happened. I swallowed. I suddenly knew who this was. It was Christian's aunt. When his parents had turned Strigoi, they'd come back for him, hoping to hide him away and turn him Strigoi when he was older. I didn't know all the details, but I knew his aunt had fended them off. As I'd observed before, though, Strigoi were deadly. She'd provided enough of a distraction until the guardians showed up, but she hadn't walked away without damage. She extended her gloved hand to me.
"Tasha Ozera," she said. "I've heard a lot about you, Rose."
I gave Christian a dangerous look, and Tasha laughed.
"Don't worry," she said. "It was all good." "No, it wasn't," he countered.
She shook her head in exasperation.
"Honestly, I don't know where he got such horrible social skills. He didn't learn them from me."
That was obvious, I thought.
"What are you guys doing out here?"
I asked.
"I wanted to spend some time with these two."
A small frown wrinkled in her forehead.
"But I don't really like hanging around the school itself. They aren't always hospitable."
I didn't get that at first. School officials usually fell all over themselves when royals came to visit. Then I figured it out.
Because of what happened.
Considering the way everyone treated Christian because of his parents, I shouldn't have been surprised to find his aunt facing the same discrimination.
Tasha shrugged. "That's the way it is."
She rubbed her hands together and exhaled, her breath making a frosty cloud in the air.
"But let's not stand out here. Not when we can build a fire inside."
I gave a last, wistful glance at the frozen pond and then followed the others inside. The cabin was pretty bare, covered in layers of dust and dirt. It consisted of only one room. There was a narrow bed with no covers in the corner and a few shelves where food had probably once been stored. There was a fireplace, however, and we soon had a blaze going that warmed the small area. The five of us sat down, huddling around its heat, and Tasha produced a bag of marshmallows that we cooked over the flames. As we feasted on that gooey goodness, Lissa and Christian talked to each other in that easy, comfortable way they always had. To my surprise, Tasha and Dimitri also talked in a familiar and light way. They obviously knew each other from way back when. I'd actually never seen him so animated before. Even when affectionate with me, there'd always been a serious air about him. With Tasha, he bantered and laughed. The more I listened to her, the more I liked her. Finally, unable to stay out of the conversation, I asked, "So, are you coming on the ski trip?" She nodded. Stifling a yawn, she stretched herself out like a cat.
"I haven't been skiing in ages. No time. Been saving all my vacation for this."
"Vacation?" I gave her a curious look. "Do you have a job?"
"Sadly, yes,"
Tasha said, though she didn't actually sound very sad about it.
"I teach martial arts classes."
I stared in astonishment. I couldn't have been more surprised if she said she was an astronaut or a telephone psychic. A lot of royals just didn't work at all, and if they did, it was usually in some sort of investment or other money-making business that furthered their family fortunes. And those who did work certainly didn't do a lot of martial arts or physically demanding jobs. Maroy had a lot of great attributes: exceptional senses, smell, sight, and hearing, and the power to work magic. But physically, they were tall and slender, often small-boned. They also got weak from being in sunlight. Now, those things weren't enough to prevent someone from becoming a fighter, but they did make it more challenging. An idea had built up among the Maroi over time that their best offense was a good defense, and most shied away from the thought of physical conflict. They hid in well-protected places like the academy, always relying on stronger, hardier dampiers to guard them.
"What do you think, Rose?"
Christian seemed highly amused by my surprise.
"Think you could take her?"
"Hard to say," I said. Tasha crooked me a grin.
"You're being modest. I've seen what you guys can do. This is just a hobby I picked up."
Dimitri chuckled.
"Now you're being modest. You could teach half the classes around here."
"Not likely," she said.
"It'd be pretty embarrassing to be beaten up by a bunch of teenagers." "I don't think that'd happen," he said. "I seem to remember you doing some damage to Neil Seltsky."
Tasha rolled her eyes.
"Throwing my drink in his face wasn't actually damage, unless you consider the damage it did to his suit, and we all know how he is about his clothes."
They both laughed at some private joke the rest of us weren't in on, but I was only half listening. I was still intrigued about her role with the Strigoi. The self-control I'd tried to maintain finally slipped. "Did you start learning to fight before or after that happened to your face?"
"Ruth," hissed Lissa.
But Tasha didn't seem upset. Neither did Christian, and he usually grew uncomfortable when the attack with his parents was brought up. She regarded me with a level, thoughtful look. It reminded me of the one I sometimes got from Dimitri if I did something surprising that he approved of. "After," she said. She didn't lower her gaze or look embarrassed, though I sensed sadness in her.
"How much do you know?"
I glanced at Christian.
"The basics."
She nodded.
I knew what Lucas and Moira had become, but that still didn't prepare me, mentally, physically, or emotionally. I think if I had to live through it again, I still wouldn't be ready. But after that night, I looked at myself, figuratively, and realized how defenseless I was. I'd spent my whole life expecting guardians to protect me and take care of me. And that's not to say the guardians aren't capable. Like I said, you could probably take me in a fight. But they, Lucas and Moira, cut down our two guardians before we realized what had happened. I stalled them from taking Christian, but just barely. If the others hadn't shown up, I'd be dead, and he'd...
She stopped, frowned, and kept going.
"I decided I didn't want to die that way, not without putting up a real fight and doing everything I could to protect myself and those I love. So I learned all sorts of self-defense, and after a while, I didn't really, fit in so well with high society around here. So I moved to Minneapolis and made a living from teaching others."
I didn't doubt there were other Maroi living in Minneapolis, though God only knew why, but I could read between the lines. She'd moved there and integrated herself with humans, keeping away from other vampires like Lissa and I had for 2 years. I started to wonder also if there might have been something else there between the lines. She'd said she'd learned all sorts of self-defense, apparently more than just martial arts. Going along with their offense-defense beliefs, the Moroi didn't think magic should be